Please keep in mind, the views expressed on the Thin Men podcast reflect those of the hosts and the hosts alone. They are not necessarily representative of the Myrna Loy Center or its staff. Thank you.
Welcome to the Thin Men podcast. I'm Biggs.
I'm Zach.
So today we're going to be talking about Hollywood blacklisting.
That's right. We found ourselves, in lieu of an interview this week, we found ourselves a special subject to sort of chat about, catch up listeners who may only have a very brief idea of what this was or no idea at all, and just give ourselves something fun to talk about.
And we're going to do this from time to time because, honestly, finding 52 performers a year
is just, it's a lot to ask.
Yeah. So, without any delay, here we go. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about the blacklisting in Hollywood history. I did a bit of research today. I knew a few things, but I looked up a few things too. So we're just going to regurgitate them.
That's
back
right.
To
we're
you.
Going to just spit information at you.
That's right. We want the audience to learn with us.
It's exposition.
That's right.
That's all it is.
So basically, this all started with the House of Un-American Activities Committee, which formed to root out communists after World War II. At some point, Joseph McCarthy kind of hijacked it and started using it for personal gain. He smeared a lot of people that he knew as enemies and basically just smeared their name because people were so terrified of communists taking over everything. And this bled into the motion picture industry around 1937 was really when it started.
Yes, when the seminal film Red Dawn debuted. That's just a joke.
That was like 84. But the person who started this, I'm sure everybody's going to be familiar with. It was Walt Disney, guys.
What a surprise.
Yeah, so Walt Disney basically put out an ad in Variety, which is still the premier magazine for film.
Yeah,
right?
the big trade paper.
He put out an ad that communist agitation was a reason for a cartoonist and animator strike at his studios. And so this touched off everything.
Which, by the way, can we just parse that sentence a little bit?
Yes.
When he says communism was responsible for agitating a strike among animators at Walt Disney Studio, what he meant was, the people I am having working on essentially indentured servant wages would like to be paid reasonably.
Yeah, you would think that communism would be his friend.
You'd think, yeah, but
I mean, he's the central figure in charge with a lot of power, and he's got a lot of people making not a lot who are all
not crazy about it. Not happy about
striking it. Striking together for a movie for little to no wages. So Walt Disney then later was called before the House of Un-American Activities Committee with a couple other names you might recognize. Gary Cooper of Helena fame.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary Cooper does not come off well.
No, he does not.
Of history, and he shouldn't, quite frankly.
Yeah. Now, I love Gary Cooper. I'll defend Gary Cooper in a lot of ways. This is one I just...
You work on the street he lived on.
Exactly. Like, I will ride for Gary Cooper, but not on this day. Yeah. I will not ride for Gary Cooper in this specific scenario.
And I lied. You don't work on the street. You work one street away
from
this
house. Yes,
one street away. Yeah, I'm sorry. He was on Rodney Street. And then Clark Gable, another name I'm sure a lot of people recognize. But maybe the biggest name of all of these names, a guy who is the president of the Screen Actors Guild and later president of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Old Ronnie boy.
Yeah. And Ronald Reagan, with his position as head of the Screen Actors Guild, which sounds insane to me that he was in charge of all these actors, he started pointing out actors that he thought were communists, mm-hmm. as did all of these people. But
yeah,
Reagan is the one that's
names.
The craziest when you hear that, because he was the one that was fighting for the actors against the studio.
He sold out the people he was supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, it's...
I will give him credit in that it is consistent with his political views. He did hate communists unfailingly for a solid 50 years, and he was never fond of labor unions.
That's true.
But generally, people who
unusual that he was in charge of
that's
one.
The thing. Generally, people who don't like labor unions, they rarely go on to head a labor union.
It actually caused a divorce between him and his first wife, Jane Wyman. She was basically sick of the fact that literally their friends were some of the people that he pointed out in the congressional hearing. So he actually dropped the dime on people that he knew. Anyway, so this basically started up the blacklisting in Hollywood.
The real catalyst for the full-on blacklist came in 47 when the Hollywood 10 were all charged with a contempt.
Well, right before that, there was a committee for the First Amendment, which was Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, John Huston, and Danny Kaye. And they were actually arguing against what Reagan and Disney and Cooper and everybody had done, and were saying that Congress should keep their business out of what people are doing in their personal lives, essentially. Humphrey Bogart eventually was pressured by Warner Brothers to basically just reverse the stance, which a lot of people had to at this. But yes, then that led to a lot of people being brought forth to Congress. I believe it was 49 people originally.
Well, the very first were the Hollywood 10.
Well,
they were the first to get charged with contempt of Congress.
Of the 49, most of them wound up eventually giving information and testifying. The Hollywood 10
were charged with contempt.
They all invoked the First Amendment
and there's some
to assemble and refused to testify.
I'll read off the names of the 10 really quick.
I got them right here.
You do? Great. Now, for people, these names are not as familiar to you. And for reasons that will become apparent as we continue talking about this.
So Herbert J. Biberman, Edward Dimitrick, Ring Lardner Jr., John Howard Lawson, Albert Maltz, Samuel Ornitz, Adrian Scott, Dalton Trumbo, and Alva Bessie.
That's them.
And so these people basically touched off a firestorm.
Now, interestingly, so Lester Cole became famous for an autobiography he wrote about the blacklistings called Hollywood Red. And he insists that all 10 of the Hollywood 10 were actually communists.
Yeah.
Hence the reason. A couple of the other members did come out and admit it. But for the most part, Lester Cole is the one who said, yeah, no, we were all communists.
I mean, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. They were the ones who would not give up because they'd be liars.
Yeah, and once again, so I lived during part of the Cold War, so I do remember some of the red hysteria, but nothing to this level. But I mean, it got into the point of where by the time I was alive and well in the world, people looked back at this as ridiculous. Like, if you're communist, so what? You know, that's your own personal views. That's supposed to be what you can do in this country. But they were being held to account. And I think a big reason why they were held to account is because they were on this big screen and they were stars. And it was kind of a pariah to strike down. But in addition to that, everybody else got struck down, too. You're talking directors,
producers,
cinematographers,
makeup artists,
writers. In fact, writers were the most common to be able to get back in. But they would use a neighbor or a friend to pretend like they were the writers.
Yeah.
And they would funnel all the work through them, which I believe they called them fronts, which is an interesting word for a person, you know.
Yes. A week after the Hollywood 10, the chair of the MPAA and a whole bunch of other major prominent members of the film industry released the Waldorf statement, which I'll read it off here. It was a 2-page statement that essentially declared the blacklist officially. So it reads, members of the Association of Motion Picture Producers deplore the actions of the 10 Hollywood men who have been cited for contempt by the House of Representatives. We do not desire to prejudge their legal rights, but their actions have been a disservice to their employers and have impaired their usefulness to the industry. We will forthwith discharge or suspend without compensation those in our employ, and we will not re-employ any of the 10 until such time as he is acquitted or has purged himself himself of contempt and declares under oath that he is not a communist. On the broader issue of alleged subversive and disloyal elements in Hollywood, our members are likewise prepared to take positive action. We will not knowingly employ a communist or member of any party or group which advocates the overthrow of the government of the United States by force or by any illegal or unconstitutional methods. In pursuing this policy, we are not going to be swayed by hysteria or intimidation from any source. We are frank to recognize that such a policy involves danger and risks. There is the danger of hurting innocent people. There is the risk of creating an atmosphere of fear. Creative work at its best cannot be carried on in an atmosphere of fear. We will guard against this danger, this risk, this fear. To this end, we will invite the Hollywood Talent Guilds to work with us to eliminate any subversives, to protect the innocent, and to safeguard free speech and a free screen wherever threatened. The absence of a national policy established by Congress with respect to the employment of communists in private industry makes our task difficult. Ours is a nation of laws. We request Congress to enact legislation to assist American industry to rid itself of subversive, disloyal elements. Nothing subversive or un-American has appeared on the screen, nor can any number of Hollywood investigations obscure the patriotic services of the 30,000 loyal Americans employed in Hollywood who have given our government invaluable aid to war and peace.
Okay, so
there's a lot of contradictions in that statement.
But it is a lot of words.
Yes. And we all know if you talk for more than 10 sentences uninterrupted, you will contradict yourself.
Okay, so in 1950, this publication called Red Channels came out. So 151 actors and actresses were listed in Red Channels. Now, here's where I want to get a little more free-flowing with this discussion, because there was a lot of famous people on that list and a lot of stories on them. And, I mean, we could never go through all of them, but there's a few of them to talk about. This really affected cinema for a long time and
from
really affected their careers. The most obvious one I can think of that really affected the careers to the point where people still don't realize that it affected his career was Orson Welles. Orson Welles was probably the most famous person listed in that, made what many people recognize as the best film ever made in Citizen Kane. And ultimately, that movie was why he got placed right on that Red Channels document. So Citizen Kane is essentially about William Randolph Hearst, and it's not kind to him.
No, it is not a favorable view.
Well, William Randolph Hearst didn't die in real life. When that movie came out, he was still very much around and very much against communists and very much against any kind of enemy. And so he saw to it that Orson Welles got added to that list. Now, if you look at Orson Welles' career, he had no movies or anything come out from 1950 to 1957. That Red Channels publication came out. He went off to Europe and just disappeared for 7 years. When he came back, he had difficulties with work. He would start a project. Things would come in behind the scenes that would complicate things and he wouldn't be able to finish it. And then eventually, he was working hard to find jobs, but he would take whatever he could grab that was in front of him. Orson Welles is known in a lot of circles for most people as being kind of a joke at the end of his life because he had fallen so far. He'd made the best movie ever and then had fallen to like selling frozen peas on commercials. But the tragedy of this is that he never actually got vocal towards the end of his life and actually started talking about it because it really affected his career forever. I mean, that's his legacy and people, they either remember him for that movie or they remember him for the failure of his career. And I mean, I just think that's kind of a disservice for him.
Absolutely. One of the people who really jumps out to me from that list, the Red Channels list, is Stella Adler. A lot of people, her name probably sounds familiar to, but they don't know why. She's actually more renowned as a legendary acting teacher. She worked with Marlon Brando. She worked under Stanislavski and with Strasberg, who are two other legendary actors and acting coaches. And it's interesting when you look at her career, she was most famous as an actress for her work on Broadway and in plays, including when she moved to Los Angeles and Hollywood. She only appeared in 3 films, one of which is Shadow of the Thin Man, which starred, of course, Myrna Loy, and that franchise is the namesake of this very podcast.
Nice. I didn't see where you're going there.
Yeah, see? But it's interesting when you sort of look at her career. She gave up acting in 1961. Her last film was in 1948. So essentially, she lost her entire Hollywood career to the blacklist, for all intents and purposes. Now, she had started coaching in 1949 and started teaching people, so she was able to sort of survive and make her name on that, but she lost two decades of her career to this.
It was interesting you brought up Marlon Brando earlier, because another one of the movies that's regarded as one of the best movies in history is On the Waterfront.
Yes.
And the director of that, Ilya Kazan, who worked with Stella Adler, he actually made On the Waterfront. And a lot of people looked at this as being a response to why he testified against a lot of actors and gave out names. If you're familiar with this movie, essentially Marlon Brando is playing a character who's a dock worker, and there's a lot of corruption on the dock, and he's just sick of it. And so he goes to trial and testifies and won't let anybody stop him from testifying. And that was his response, which is kind of awful, but it is a great movie. Now, when you go on the opposite side of that, so a guy named Arthur Miller, who you might
legendary
be familiar
playwright.
With, yeah, was also friends with Kazan, and they had a huge falling out when he testified. And guess what one of the names is that came up on that list?
Surprise, surprise,
yeah,
Arthur Miller.
And so Arthur Miller is very well might be the only figure in this who came out stronger because of it. I'm sure it was difficult during the time, but he wrote The Crucible, which is his masterpiece. I mean, it's I think it's the one most people go to when they think of it. I mean, you got Death of a Salesman.
I think Death of a Salesman well, is the one most people go to.
Oh, man.
That one gets referenced so much in popular
culture.
But
The Crucible gets referenced a lot, too. And it's got a Winona Ryder movie. You know, it's got that 90s look.
It's true.
It can be argued that The Crucible is a masterpiece anyway.
Well,
I would
unquestioningly, it's a masterpiece in regards to whether or not it's his most known is really the debatable part.
Okay.
He's one of those people who is lucky to have more than one masterpiece.
Yes. Like Mark Twain, for example.
Yes.
But I don't want to get too off the topic here. So The Crucible is directly about the blacklisting in Hollywood. I mean, you have people who get called in on the Salem witch trials, and then, you know, they have enemies, and so they turn over their enemies so that they can get off the hook, but then also destroy their enemies. I mean, it was just this rotting thing that just kept spreading out. And so he wrote The Crucible about that, but hit it superficially as the Salem yes. witch trial. Because you know, if he had just written a play about, you know,
the blacklisting,
about the blacklist, like directly about it,
wouldn't
have
gone
over so
great.
Well.
Would not have flown.
But it's a great play. Charlie Chaplin,
very famously.
Yep. He got deported from the United States and was just gone. And he only came back once. Like, he was very upset and said, I wouldn't come back if Jesus Christ was the president. Surrendered his papers and everything because he was so upset about it. And he came back in 1972 to collect an Oscar, where he got a standing ovation. I think it was probably a lifetime achievement.
It was a
award.
Lifetime achievement, yeah.
And then never came back.
Disappeared.
Yep. That was the only time he sat back on U.S. soil. And he had to have been regarded as the number one comedic force at the time. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Like a master in his own era.
Yeah.
Another interesting name on the list. This one is interesting, especially to people who are less film buff and classic film buff and more pop culture buffs. Burgess Meredith, a.k.a. Mickey from the Rocky films and the Penguin from the 60s Batman TV show.
You know, I read that and I could not find any information on how it affected him. And I looked at his IMDb. Dude never stopped working.
I know, right? It's amazing.
He must have given up names immediately.
Yeah, I know. He must have been one of those guys who's like, oh, I don't want to be on this list. Turn around.
Everybody I worked with on Batman. Yeah. No, that hadn't happened
that
yet.
Hadn't happened yet. But he did say, trust me, Sylvester Stallone will be a communist one day.
And he would be wrong, because in Rocky IV,
he
single-handedly
communism.
Ended communism.
But that's what happens when you drop dimes on everyone.
That's
now,
right.
At this point, are we just sort of spitting on his grave? I don't know how many people he dropped dimes on.
Burgess Meredith? No, I don't know. It's obviously slanderous, since I don't know, but the fact that he never stopped working makes me think he dropped some names. Mm-hmm. I mean, dude never had an interruption in work.
Which
so.
Is amazing. It's impressive. Mm-hmm. I'll say that.
Yeah. For most people, even if they gave names,
there were still some breaks in there because people just didn't want to be associated with someone on the list.
Yes.
So the fact that he was able to consistently work at all is a shock.
So basically, the blacklist ended when a man named Alfred Hitchcock started hiring people from the blacklist. Didn't care. He was English. He was at the top of his game.
One was going to argue with him.
No, nobody's going to argue. And people were a little afraid of Alfred Hitchcock, too.
People are still a little afraid of Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, but 1957, he started putting people on TV. And then other people were like, oh, he can do that? And it just ended. It just ended right there. 6 years before McCarthyism ended, Alfred Hitchcock ended
just
it.
Just decided blacklisting is done. He's like, yeah, this is stupid. And everyone was like, yeah, this is stupid.
It's amazing that a British...
it's that easy.
British gave us our country, and then the British, like, reined in our media.
Honestly, I really do think part of it is just that we respect British accents and assume that British accent means smarter.
And that was Charlie Chaplin's downfall in the end, is he never talked on screen.
He never spoke on screen. He would have saved him.
Okay, so obviously this is a slightly dopey look at this.
Yes, we like to play a little more lighthearted.
But if you're interested in this topic, why not go to your public library and get on the computer, because nobody looks at books anymore.
I don't even know what a book is.
It's you know, in movies when somebody's really smart and they have those rectangular things behind them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those are books.
Oh, yeah. Paper movies.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I know paper movies.
No, I don't want to love you. Cause I know how you are. That's why I've been staying away from you. That's why I haven't called you, 'cause I know you could possess my body. I know you could make me scrawl.
Okay, so today we're going to review the movie The Theory of Everything. This is a movie about Stephen Hawking.
His early relationship, his early years meeting Jane Hawking, his wife, and his time at Oxford.
And it's based off of a book that his wife wrote.
Yes.
The second book that she wrote.
Yes, the redo.
So I've not read either book, but my understanding of the first book was it tore him down pretty hard. And then she got a little bit of distance and perspective and I guess became friends with him again. And,
yeah, they grew back together. I think it was one of those things where I really view it as these people spent so much time together, in such a unique bonding situation that came with sort of the tragedy of Stephen's illness. And we're so genuinely in love with one another that I think it manifested itself in very real rage and dislike on the part of both parties, and then came back to a realization that they didn't want to have each other out of each other's lives forever.
Yeah, I think it was hatred and divorce, and then in the end they have kids together, so you just have to be able to get along to some degree.
Yeah.
Especially when kids are not grown up. I think you have to learn to live with each other. But that's for another podcast.
Yeah, that is for...
We have a podcast on tearing down scientific geniuses.
Yes.
So if you want to hear that, it's on the Not Safe for Network. But right now we're going to be talking about this movie. So it opens, we see Stephen Hawking recklessly tearing down the road on his bicycle.
People don't know this about Stephen Hawking now, with sort of the modern view of him, that he was never like the classic stodgy scientist. Like, he was a guy who liked to mess around and make bad decisions and be reckless. Like, he was just another 19-year-old, 20-year-old jerk for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't even, at least the portrayal of him wasn't so much a jerk.
Jerk in a sort of colloquial sense.
Okay. He just seemed like a dude who wanted to have a good time and a couple of beers and was awkward around a woman. We don't really know if it's women or not.
That may very well have been the only woman he ever knew. Untrue. He did have a second wife.
Yeah.
And
she was in the film.
Yep.
Even though they don't say it in the film, but
she's there.
Yeah. And they hint at it. Anyway, so he meets this girl. It seems like it's going to work out really well. And then he sees another guy at the pub and is kind of broken down by it. But eventually they wind up getting together. In the midst of this, he's trying to figure out his paper that he's going to write for Cambridge. You know, I'm not smart enough to really say what the theory is that he's working on. But he basically, it's not the one that he gets famous for. It's pretty much the opposite of it.
Yes, it's the wrong one.
Yeah, but gets him a lot of fame within Cambridge, which is fortunate because then we see the struggle he hits right as he starts dating this girl.
Jane Wilde.
He starts to get Lou Gehrig's disease and it starts to affect him. We see him just, there's a scene it's in the trailers. He's walking down the street and all of a sudden he just loses control of his body and he just hits the concrete so hard. It's just the sound when
he hits
it.
It's very chilling. It's that crack.
Yeah. And then of course they do that kind of noise, which is, that's always shorthand for your
brain's putting right now.
Yeah. There are some really literal painful scenes to watch in this movie. Not that you have to have a strong stomach or anything, but there's three scenes that are kind of hard
to
take to
watch.
Yeah. So essentially this movie from then on out is his soon to be wife basically coping with the fact that he has Lou Gehrig's disease and really wanting to fight with him through it. And he's only supposed to be able to live for 2 years, which this was in 1966 that the movie starts. So obviously dude's made it quite a bit longer than he was projected.
Cleared the timeline.
Yeah. So we start out by seeing she's very much the loving, doting wife.
Yeah, she becomes almost a motherly figure as much as she is a romantic figure for him.
She basically helps him with every new phase of his life because what you don't think about, Stephen Hawking wasn't normal one day and then just became this dude in a wheelchair.
It was a gradual decline.
Yeah. It's kind of the origin story of the Stephen Hawking we know now.
It is to a certain degree. You are
a little bit. This is what superhero movies have done to me, because when he gets the computer, I was so excited.
That was his Iron Man putting on the suit.
Finally, he's gonna have the voice that I recognize. The voice that how many millions of people have. I'm just like, yes. That's terrible.
Well, actually, now he has since copyrighted that specific voice.
Really?
Yeah, they don't produce new words in it for anyone other than him.
I didn't know
that. Yep, he has since copyrighted the voice.
See, that's what happens.
Which is why they had to get his permission to use it in the film.
So he had to approve of this movie, essentially. Uh-huh. That's funny that you say that, too, because I heard the voice and was just like, oh, finally, it's the Stephen Hawking I know and love. And part of it is it also gets a little difficult to understand what he's saying at parts. Because the actor's speaking like I would imagine somebody with Lou Gehrig's disease would have to speak. But it does get awfully hard to understand what he's saying.
You have that moment where you're sitting in a chair like, man, I kind of wish there were subtitles for this scene. And then you feel like a jerk for wishing there were subtitles in that scene.
They do it all the time in movies,
I know. And on reality TV. If
the question is really angry, they're going to put stuff below it.
Uh-huh. Or if someone's drunk enough. In any case, that's a digression we don't need to go down on this podcast.
It'll be edited out, I'm sure. A lot of this is seen through her eyes. You know, at first she's trying to be the doting wife, and she's succeeding at it, and she's helping him through these phases, but you can see that she's getting overwhelmed at a certain point. And it's something that I can understand because I am a caregiver by trade. I'm also a parent, and so to do those two things simultaneous must be impossible. And I was even thinking about that in scenes. Like, there's one scene where she's pushing his chair down to Cambridge, and then I'm thinking, where's the kid? Because, she has a kid.
And she's probably thinking the same thing. Where's the kid?
Yeah, might be. I mean, that's got to be difficult. But they even have one scene where he's racing around in his wheelchair and he's knocking things over, playing around. Mm-hmm. And the kids are, on top of him. And it's you can just tell the look she's doing because it's great. I have three kids I've got to take care of.
Yeah.
You know, and she's including her husband in this. Now, she gets another kid later, but that's another matter.
And we should note, Jane Hawking is played by Felicity Jones.
Who does a great job.
And who is the youngest looking 31-year-old I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. She looks like she's 23.
Yeah, I actually
even when they age her up a little bit towards the end of the movie, she looks like she's 23. It's so impressive.
Yeah, I actually thought they had somebody pretty young in the movie and then just aged her up.
Yeah,
anyway.
It really is two impressive lead performances. Eddie Redmayne plays Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, and so he does the best he can, but at a certain point, he really can't do much of anything. So it makes her performance even better because at a certain point he's twisted up.
Yeah,
he's got to use his eyes for communication, but there's not really a whole lot that he can do at that point.
It's not the most dynamic thing in the world. Where the impressive...
He's doing exactly what he needs to do as that character, but that's where her performance gets even
really
better.
Really shines.
Is she has to bounce off of him, but she's got to bounce off this monotone thing on a computer.
It's almost similar to actors like bouncing off CGI characters in movies. Like you're essentially reacting to nothing.
Basically, yeah.
The impressive nature of Redmayne's performance really comes in the work, where you learn like he had to chart which muscles stopped working in which order so that he would do it so they would film it properly and the continuity would work. And so his stuff is very much behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
Hers is very much out in the open. And especially towards the end of the movie, it blossoms into from a very good performance to a great performance.
Yeah. So it's a couple of really good performances. So her character, essentially, at a certain point, her mother recognizes that she needs a break and a respite, if you will. So she suggests that she goes and sings at a church. And this just opens up a whole can of worms because now she starts... I think we can assume she's seeing this guy.
Yes.
You could tell this movie is English because there's a lot of innuendo.
they do sort of
there's
beat
innuendo,
around the bush.
But they don't say it. Ever just insinuate a lot, but yeah, and I don't know how much of this to talk about.
Yeah, we are getting into a point now where we're at risk of giving away the climax and ending of the film.
Yeah, and my wife, who didn't get to go with me, I made a comment about the end of the film and she got really mad that I said something. I was like, it happened in real life, you can't spoil it. You basically repeated what you said last episode. She wasn't having that. Uh-huh. She was not happy with that response.
Yeah, there are people who... It turns out that just because it already happened does not mean everyone knows about it.
Yeah. I thought everybody knew about Stephen Hawking's wife, right? Yes.
So suffice it to say, for her, it very much becomes a character who's torn between what she almost feels obligated to do and what she wants to do.
Yeah.
And it becomes about that dichotomy.
At the end of the day, I really enjoyed the movie. It was an interesting character study. Something I did like about it was there was literally not one villain in this movie. That seems to be a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, even the Charlie Cox character, who would have been so easy to play off as like this other man who's a real jerk, comes off amazingly well.
Yeah, and maybe it was with all the nuance they did with him fooling around with Hawking's wife. Yeah, you really can't watch this movie and hate any of the characters, I think.
Which actually is sort of refreshing.
Yeah.
In when movies are becoming increasingly cynical with at least one character, it's nice to have a movie where even if you're not rooting for everyone, you're not rooting against anyone either.
Well, I would actually go the other way in that I would say this is almost a newer idea that's starting to pop up, because rare is the movie where there's not a villain. And then when you go back, villains get so much more obvious over time.
Yes.
I mean, just like think about Westerns with the black hats and white hats. Like,
uh-huh.
It's ridiculous, dude. Like, they had
you
a
may
dress
as well have
code.
A name tag.
Yeah. So it's really refreshing that they could actually do this and not have a villain. And it's impressive that she did wind up writing this where there wasn't any bad guys.
It shows, it really reflects well on Jane Hawking, like you say, where it reflects someone who has, and yes, I know the redo we've already talked. You know, we talked about that mere minutes ago, right?
I just smiled.
I could see it in your eyes. I was like, we've already talked about this. It's already happened. It was in the past. It reflects well on her that with time, because apparently I have to spell out everything.
I'm an American audience, lest I get
the side eyes if I don't spell out everything.
I didn't say anything.
I know, I got the side eyes.
I was just laughing.
I got the side eyes. I knew it was coming. In any case, it reflects well that with time, she was able to present this situation where it would have been so easy to use this memoir essentially to tear people down, as people often do, to use it to name names and air dirty laundry, that she did it to sort of show a more positive side of relationships, even relationships that do end.
Yeah, in the end, I felt like it was a pretty positive movie. They didn't dwell on any of the negative stuff for too long. So it was, in the end, you could go out smiling and feel good about it, you know?
And it's a hard line to balance when you go for a positive movie like this, to not be overwhelmingly so and be saccharine with how sweet and optimistic it is.
So one thing that really stood out to me by the end of the movie was most biopics I've seen, and I do mean most, there's just something about them that feels so fake. This movie didn't fall in that trap, but there's just so many biopics. The example I'll give was there's this Monkees movie that I watch.
Oh, boy.
All right. It's my go-to moment when I talk about biopics. They get really upset because they're in the studio. They didn't fire a producer that they were supposed to fire or something. And he looks at the producer in the face. And I think it was, I want to say it was, who's the guy with the wool cap?
Oh,
I think it was Peter, Lord, maybe?
I can't remember. Anyway. I know one of them's Davey. I can't
That's
remember.
Not Davey.
No, I know it's not Davey. Because I know which one is Davey, and you know which one is Davey.
No, it's not Peter Tork. It's Michael Nesmith. Okay. So Michael Nesmith looks at the producer and he punches a hole in the wall right next to him. He goes, "That could have been your face." Now,
that's an extreme example.
It is, but it's my go-to one because it always sticks out of my head. But almost every biopic I've seen has that kind of moment in it.
Yeah.
Where it's just so obviously written and hammed up, and it doesn't come off well. And the singer ones are always the worst, too.
Oh, yeah.
If you have a singer in it, you can just count on it not working. The second you put a singer in your biopic movie, you just know, they're going to try and incorporate a song into whatever they're talking about for an aha moment.
There's going to be a lot of forced connections between things that don't need to be connected.
Exactly. And that was what was nice about this movie is they delved in that just a teeny, teeny, tiny bit, but they made it seem more realistic. There's a part where she's putting a sweater over his head and it gets stuck because she's hearing the baby cry and he's looking through a hole in the sweater and sees the fire. And then it kind of turns into a depiction of the sun in a black hole. And he gets his idea, but it's more visual.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't come off as really hammy when you see it. And I guess that's what I got to say is this movie didn't fall into the ham trap. It could have been a giant ham sandwich.
Easily
and it
could have been
to avoid that
over the top, hyper cheesy corn fest.
And I gotta say, it can't be easy because every biopic practically falls into that trap.
And it has to be especially difficult when the person you're making the movie about is still alive and can see the movie.
Maybe that helped it out.
I was thinking that actually while you were talking about it, I think you see that most in the biopics where the people are dead and can't say anything. No, that's stupid.
The studio just green lights it.
Exactly.
They just have to get one member of the family to sign off on
it. Exactly. And so I think when the person's alive, I think the benefit of doing a biopic on someone who's dead is that you've got more time to sort of see the totality of their life and their work and sort of draw the narrative arc from it. But when they're alive, it forces you to play your cards more intelligently. It forces you to go less for drama and more for accuracy just because you know that person can call you on it.
And another thing that biopics can really fail with is if they end at the wrong point.
Oh, yeah.
You want to end it at least around the peak of the character. You know, you don't want to miss obvious peaks and valleys of the guy's life. So in this, we don't get to see him do his PBS show. We don't get to see him do Futurama, but we do get to see his book come out and be really successful. Yes. And that is something that if they hadn't included that book, you'd just be why did I watch this movie?
They
you
also
know, like the thing he's famous for, they don't even mention it. Sometimes biopics make that mistake.
Yeah, and the two mistakes that are easiest for biopics to fall in are going with too wide a focus on trying to capture their entire life when someone's entire life is not going to be interesting all the time. It's just not.
Yeah.
And the other way is sometimes it works out really well where you focus on a specific moment in someone's life. But if you've bring that focus in too fine, you end up alienating the people who love or respect the figure you're making the work of.
Yeah. Now, they don't say what year this ends in, but it seems to me like it's probably like 81, 82, yeah, somewhere 80s. Around there.
It feels like very 80s. Very looks early very 80s.
Like
yeah.
Still kind of a 70s.
Yeah, it's the 70s hangover.
So the thing is, it's in mostly takes place in Britain, so it's tough to tell.
Yeah, because, that's the other thing. Britain.
Because as soon as it goes over into the United States towards the end, I'm like, oh, that's the early 80s. Which, like, kudos to them for not falling in that trap either. Like, you know, the American people aren't walking around wearing British clothes, and
yeah.
And the British people aren't walking around wearing neon blue and, like, hot pink mini skirts yep. or whatever. So, you know, it feels accurate to the period.
Here's one thing I will give them a whole bunch of credit for, just because it impressed me with the amount. There's one shot where you can see a whole bunch of cars all at one time, or a relative lot of cars, and they're all period, every last one of them. Yeah. And that impressed the hell out of me. I still don't know how they pulled it off.
Yeah, when I was watching this, I was like, they must have sunk some money into this movie. Uh-huh. I mean, it really seems period appropriate.
Because usually when you do the big wide shot with a bunch of cars in a period film, you can
there's
always
only
pick
one or two.
And you can always pick out a couple that are definitely not period. Yeah. But in this, I couldn't pick them out. So maybe I just missed them, but I think they pulled it off.
So how long is it going to be at the Loy for?
Well, it just opened, so it will be here at least another week. Almost definitely longer. Okay. It's been, people have been coming out to see it, and you should too.
And hey, you might learn a little something too.
I wonder, my little darling, where can you be again tonight? While the moon is shining bright, I wonder, my heart is aching. Why for you can our love be mistaken? Darling, don't you say that this must mean our ending, I wonder.
All right, so thank you for joining us. I hope you learned a little something, or at least were entertained along the way. You can still see The Theory of Everything at the Merlin Loy Center playing now. I'd like to thank our guest, us. And
yeah, we were awesome.
We did. We really, really nailed it this week. We are not going to have an episode next week. We're taking a Christmas break because we love our families more than we love you. But we still love you, so we will be back the following week to talk about Whiplash and with some special guests. Until then,
stay listening.
Yay!
Well, 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 little baby, will you think of me every day? Though I may be a million miles away, I wonder, think of me every day. Though I may be a million miles away, I wonder.
Hello, what can I do for you today?
Well, I am looking for Christmas presents for my family. Just, I really let it go this year. Do you have anything good for me?
Of course, the We Had a Good Life podcast, which you can find on the Not Safer Network.
A podcast? I guess I was thinking more like a Furby, maybe?
Maybe Montucky Skies is more up your alley.
I guess, is that also a podcast? Because again, I'm looking for something a little more tangible.
Podcast? Why, speak no further. We've got Box Office Battle.
You know, I gotta say, I'm beginning to feel like you're not listening. listening to me, again, looking for gifts like I can put in a box or a bag and wrap them for my friends and family.
Perhaps shooting the show would be more your speed.
You know, work with me, not for me. Let's work as a, let's try to attack this as a team. Again, gifts, family.
Is your family into art?
Sure, yeah.
Well, then the Thin Man podcast would be right up your alley.
All right, do you have something that's not a podcast? Because this is a little frustrating.
Real Roulette isn't a podcast anymore, but we do have the archives available on the Not Safe for Network.
I mean, it seems pretty clear at this point you have an agenda. You're not going to sell me the toy robot. You're not going to sell me the beautiful handbag. And you're not going to sell me that cool poncho. What are you going to sell me?
That's debatable. It's a podcast about arguing.
You know, I gotta say, at this point, I feel like I understand arguing. So I'm tempted, but again, not what I'm looking for.
So you're looking for something tangible that you can hold in your hands.
Ideally.
Well, why not the Not Safe for Network podcast, which you can hold in your hands on your iPod or MP3 player?
Sure, that counts.